Stop me if you've heard this, but the fun drive is over. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome to the roundtable panel. We're thrilled. The fun drive ended yesterday morning in the 11 o'clock hour, and we're just overjoyed. We want to thank all of you. We have so many people to thank, and we've been doing that, but I just want to say to anyone and to everyone who pledged and called and went to devices and did all the stuff they're supposed to do, whether you did it early or you're sustaining or you did it in the lockbox or you did it during the drive. However you did it, if you're a new member, whatever the case may be, we thank you from the bottom of our hearts. It was an absolutely beautiful drive and a lovely, lovely time that we had. Yes, we're glad it's over and that we can move on, but we are thrilled. So now we're back. We kept on saying, once we make the money, we're back to regular programming. And since noon yesterday, we've been back to regular programming. I just forgot how to say the word. We are thrilled to be back and to have you with us, and we will make the best of it this morning with a terrific group of panelists, and thank all of you for what you did and to make the station whole. Thanks to the incredible work by the staff and our volunteers and all of the people who helped out, our community partners. It was really a very, very special event. We love you so much, and we thank you again, from the bottom of our hearts. So now we move on, and we won't talk about money for a couple weeks.
Yeah. 5 minutes.
Every four months. Okay. Teresa Bourgeois is here, public policy and communications expert. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing just fine. Thank you very much. And thanks to all who contributed and so many people, so many new members, so many existing folks. It was just wonderful.
I want to tell all of you that a lot of people who were so complimentary of the panels, and that's such a part of people's lives, and I just hope you know how special you are in the hearts and minds of our listeners. It was lovely. We got wonderful comments. You were, I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you.
I did hear a lot of love for the roundtable, so that's great.
Yeah, it's very nice.
Wonderful.
It's
a great community.
This much job security, JP. This
much. That's all you need.
Yeah. Last night I'm feeling guilty because I'm sitting there and I'm watching the basketball game, and I'm feeling all guilty because I'm not reading all this stuff.
I put the stories out
and I'm like, and I feel really guilty because then I feel like Jiminy Cricket visits me because I know Teresa is like knee deep in all of this stuff and has watched all the hearings and has done reports. It was around midnight or 11:30. I get a text from Teresa that says, "Wow, are you watching this? I'm not even reading the stories. I'm watching this game."
It was unbelievable. I was going to hold back, but oh my God, what a game!
It was.
I mean, I'm a Celtics fan, but oh my goodness! And you knew they were going to win. It's like that the horse that the woman trained. What's the name of her horse?
Golden Tempo.
Way behind, but you could just see it was going to happen. It was unbelievable.
Well,
you uncorked me.
I have to say,
I'm totally unprepared, but I loved the game.
At the half, I didn't think anything was going to happen, and then the third quarter was better, but not. I was like,
you could just feel it.
But then the cork went out of the bottle, and it was just amazing.
And that
absolutely
the,
amazing.
The last shot,
the final
oh,
shot.
Oh my goodness! Where he just put it up there and let his partner do his thing. It was
one
unbelievable.
More. I was at Finnegan's around the corner here. There were people literally dancing.
Really?
I mean, they were just like, we got to bring it home. It's like so exciting. So
I was screaming and yelling. I was by myself. I'm really a Celtics fan, not so much a Knicks fan, but it was just such amazing basketball.
Good stuff.
Now, on a separate note, saying something positive about San Antonio that you would love. The players have a book club.
Well, that's cool.
They're reading 1984.
They're reading it. We're living
it.
Isn't that amazing? A book club among the players.
Very
anyway,
nice.
Great game. Great, great, great. Very, wonderful celebration.
The Empire Reports J.P. Miller put the Nick victory right on the top of the page. That's a big story today.
I did. It's a big story, but I have to confess that I saw the 27 or 28 point deficit at halftime, and I said they have no chance and went to bed. And so I didn't get to participate with everybody else. I couldn't believe it when I woke up in the morning, though, and saw it. Couldn't believe it.
I have to say, though, in your defense, don't start these games at 8:30 at night. I mean,
yeah, what's that all about?
Come on. And what I think about, and forgive me, but it's for the children. The kids want to watch these games. It's too damn late for them to watch a game and then get up in the morning because they're not getting over till midnight, for goodness sakes. And I realize it's the West Coast and all of that, that they have to do their thing too. But good Lord, that just seems very, very late to me.
Yeah, the kids tend to, we have them, they can watch the first half and then wake up the next morning and watch the second half taped.
That's
which
exciting.
Is a good, which
That's
is
good.
A good compromise.
Good way to do it. Judy Patrick joins us, former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, longtime editor at the Daily Gazette. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. I made a half-hearted attempt to find the game. I couldn't find it. So I read this really nice article by Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan about the details of the Epstein file.
That
cover
should be
up.
Quite a
so,
book, shouldn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I read the headline. I thought I can't, I'm too, good. Can't focus. That was a need to focus on that article.
There's a lot of stuff there. Well, yes. I'm just amused that you couldn't find ABC.
Yeah. I was not going to say that.
No, she does don't have, live out in Greenwood.
I do live in
Greenwood. I
cut a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's all according to what kind of cable you may or may not have.
I don't have cable.
If it's, well, if it's an antenna, then, you know.
Yeah, the antenna goes in and out.
Right.
I would like to mention, in my life as a reporter, I used to cover the media, and I would write about the fund drives every time they happened.
Yeah.
And one year, it was probably 20 years ago, I wrote that I referred to them as the quarterly fund drives. Well, I got a call.
Oh, gee, from who?
From Alan Shartok, who nicely reminded me that these were not quarterly fund drives. They happened only three times a year. So I think WAMC has prided itself on these three times a year.
Yeah, it's typical in public radio every 4 months, and we do it. And you know...
But it's an atypical fund drive, isn't it? I mean, it's just people like it.
Yes, they do. They do.
For
and
the
it's,
first few
and
days.
It's, and look, it's a June fund drive always goes longer. People are out of the routine, even though the weather stinks right now. It's, you know, it's still, it's, it takes a little bit longer. But as I've said 400 times over the last week, you walked into any nonprofit and said, we can make $1.25 million in 6 days.
Yeah.
You know, who would turn you down?
Yeah.
So there's that. Libby Post is with us, political consultant, lobbyist, dear friend. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good. You know, things are just hopping. I'm waiting for the primary to be over, and then life goes on. But I do want to take a moment, and I'm sure she's going to kill me for this, but to wish Lynn a happy anniversary. We've been together 31 years today.
31 years?
Congratulations.
Yes. That's wonderful.
Yeah. And married 14, you know, because get married.
Because
it was the end. Our marriage was the end of a 17-year engagement, is what I like
that
to say.
That is wonderful. So you got married in what year?
2012.
Or you met in what year? I'm sorry.
95. Oh, well, we met. A long time before.
Yeah.
We met on Helen DeFosse's campaigns.
Oh.
I was
how
running.
Fun.
She was helping with fundraising and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, happy.
Well, happy anniversary.
Thank you.
I think Kelly and I have a year on you. We were we got married in 94.
Yeah.
So
it's just amazing that it just goes like this. It really does.
Well, and one of my favorite people. So, Lynn. And
yes.
You.
Yeah, no, Lynn really is. I get it, really.
Quickly.
I totally understand.
Well, congratulations. And again, have a beautiful celebration. And thank you for being here this morning. Okay, so we go to the news, and that's what we're going to focus on. We'll be with you the full time here today. Back to the regular. And... U.S. launching new strikes on Iran hours after Trump issued a warning. U.S. Central Command said it went after, quote, multiple targets after the president said Tehran would pay the price for not making a deal. The U.S. launched strikes on multiple targets in Iran late Wednesday afternoon, that is Eastern time in the U.S. Central Command said in a statement without providing further details, explosion could be heard in several southern Iranian cities, according to semi-official Iranian news outlets. I did not ask exactly. I do ask, but I don't know what semi-official means in this case. Anyway, President Donald Trump had said that Iran would have to pay the price after it responded to earlier U.S. strikes with a wave of attacks targeting U.S. assets across the Middle East overnight, adding to a fresh cycle of violence that threatens to upend the increasingly shaky ceasefire between the two countries. Is it still a ceasefire when bombs are falling?
No, Joe.
Okay. That is a technical question I had. Trump on Wednesday morning appeared to threaten further military action. On Truth Social, saying they've taken too long to negotiate a deal that would have been great for them. We're going to be attacking them and attacking them very hard, Trump told reporters in the Oval Office ahead of the renewed strikes. Earlier Wednesday, he said that an agreement was a day or two away. Persian Gulf states have a legal and moral responsibility to prevent their territory from being used by the United States and Israel for further attacks, the ministry said in a statement, adding that Iran would not hesitate to exercise its inherent right to defend itself. All right, JP.
I'm not surprised by this. You know, this has been going on for months, and Trump has a significant disadvantage at the negotiating table with Iran in terms of ending this war, and Iran knows that, and so they're not going to go along with his demands, and they know that the longer this goes on, the more it hurts Trump and his party in the United States, and Iran with, you know, they have relatively unlimited money with their oil reserves. So when we destroy their infrastructure, they can just go build it, you know, over the coming 6 months, and they don't care if we go kill their people. You know, they're dictators. They don't care if we kill their people. And so, it's really hard. This is a big reason why for however many decades we haven't gone to war with Iran, because this is a very it's a very challenging thing to navigate this and to come out on top. And right now it looks like for Trump going in and conducting this war, that we are going to come out less financially stable as a country, less secure as a country. The region is going to be less secure, and Iran is going to be stronger than they were before we went in.
Judy.
What a mess, don't you think? It's the equivalent of a schoolyard bully fight, it seems to me, oftentimes. In this case, it sounds like the downing of the Black Hawk is what really set things off, whether it was an accident or was it intentional. What I was hearing later in the day was that there were signs indicating this was an intentional attack to try to down the helicopter and kill U.S. servicemen. Whatever the case, the longer this goes on, the more the likelihood is that someone is going to get killed or some major incident is going to happen that's going to accelerate this and intensify the violence. So clearly the American public is really against this war. Trump saying that he doesn't, he just is trying to negotiate this, you know, via social media or via these weird comments. But, you know, just ask anybody from the Jimmy Carter administration of what Iran can do to you politically over the long haul. I mean, they have the patience, they know what they're doing, and they are just outsmarting us in this case.
The thing that I find interesting, and I maybe I'm reading into it too much, but and Teresa, you may know the language better than I do here, but the president keeps saying that they have an agreement, that they have put together their agreement, and they're just waiting for Iran to sign off on it. And I take that sort of as, here's our list of demands, right? And they have to respond to that, which is different, obviously, than something that is a negotiated agreement.
Right. So there is a big difference between the two. And that's one of the things that a number of experts have been saying, is that what it appears that they have is a list of sort of a framework for a discussion about an agreement. And it often takes months, sometimes years, to actually get to all of the language. You know, once you get a framework, then the diplomats who do this all the time have to sit down and really put all the words to paper. And the sad irony here, of course, is in the end, what you need to end up with, which is the JTPOA, right, which he ripped up. But the cost of getting from here to there is enormous amounts of loss of people, of loss of resources, of economic pain all around the world. That's the ripple effect of this. But yes, by all accounts, what they have is a framework for a possible agreement. But the devil is in the details of those waters. But I'd like to focus on one very specific thing about this that the news of the last week has been really troubling to me, which is the news that the U.S. Bombed in a very targeted way the water supply.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. As a friend of mine, I said, you know, isn't that illegal? So Geneva Convention, Article 54, protection of objects indispensable to the survival of the civilian population. You can't destroy those. One of the starvation of civilians as a method of warfare is prohibited. It's prohibited to attack, destroy, remove, or render useless objects indispensable to the survival of the civilian population, such as foodstuffs, agricultural areas of production, crops, livestock, drinking water installations, and supplies and irrigation works for the specific purpose of denying them for their sustenance value to the civilian population, to the adverse party. It goes on and on and on. If you think about what the U.S. is doing all around the world in terms of violation of this Article 54, deliberately attacking water infrastructure in the last week, it's just unclear to me why that hasn't gotten more attention. But think about them firing on fishing boats off the coast of Venezuela. Think about what they're doing in Cuba, denying not just fuel, but now food and medicine. There were reports in the last week of children and others dying because they can't get access to medicine because of our blockade. Think about in the United States the number of children. There's a new report out from Jacob Safaroff, and he's working with an external group about families in detention and including babies and the numbers of them, and they're being held well past the time that's allowed. Think about the Ebola outbreaks that are uncontained and we're not providing the resources or withholding the medications for. Anyway, the list goes on, and I just think that the Trump-Vance administration is what it is, but I'll say the same thing I've said over and over again. Where is the pushback from the Republicans in the House and the Senate? And, you know, this has really long-term implications for how we are treated in the world. But in any case, I know that's just a small part of it. But I just think that, you know, what's going on in Gaza in our name and with our resources, this no limited food getting in, and now there's a report out today about the ethnic cleansing in parts of that area. But bombing water infrastructure, you just can't do that.
Libby Post.
Well, you know, another story we read for this morning was about how all the women are being fired or forced out, replaced by men. So this is an administration totally focused on testosterone. And when that's what happens, that's what drives everything, and we know that that's what drives Trump being a man, being macho, constantly proving himself or thinking he's proving himself to the world stage by being tough. This is what happens. And he has no idea what he's doing. And neither does Hegseth. Not, you know, they don't know what they're doing in this war. They have no clue why they got in, really. There's never been a rational reason for starting this thing, right? And this has just undermined, thankfully, his credibility a bit with some people. I, too, think, I also wonder, where are the Republicans that he ran people against and lost, like John Cronin and Massey? Where are they? They have nothing to lose now by speaking up against what Trump is doing. They're not going to be reelected, and somebody has to have a backbone. But this is just another distraction that's costing everybody a lot of money to take people's attention away from the things that are can really undo Trump, which is the Epstein files. And they will continue to do whatever they need to do to distract until that whole thing goes away, which we all know is not going to go away. So we're going to be living with this kind of foreign policy, domestic policy that totally targets people who are poor, totally targets folks that are without any kind of defense, you know, bombing water, bombing all the various places that they've been bombing. And it's just all about making sure that he remains in the presidency. But he's going to feel it at the midterms. And people aren't buying this reaction from him that, oh, inflation's going to go back down once we're out of this war, right? Oh, it's really not that bad. You know, I mean, that's people are not going to buy it, and it's going to have an impact on the midterms. And, you know, I know that the redistricting and everything else, but I am not convinced that all of those NOPs, people without party affiliation, or Republicans for that matter, in some of those areas where they've been doing the redistricting are going to be lockstep with the Republicans because of how their lives have been turned upside down by this man. There was a report this morning about rural health care that and how many people are going to be off without health insurance. I mean, there's major impacts here. And all they're doing is playing in the Middle East so to distract everybody from all the stuff that's going on nationally.
Well, I think you are seeing pushback today because of the nomination of Pulte, the housing guy, to
yes.
oversee the national security infrastructure and their group of provisions that are need to be reauthorized by tomorrow. Yes, by tomorrow. And that's not happening because the Republicans are not agreeing to move ahead. And this is the guy who has a housing background, and he's the one who provided the mortgage information that was used to go after Tish James and a whole host of other people legally, or probably illegally, but to say that they did something wrong in those cases have mostly been thrown out. But I think in one small case, the Republicans seem to be pushing back on that because they can't get these reauthorized. But yesterday's press avail, where it was at the signing for the $70 billion in increase in funding for ICE, and I thought that we just needed more Kristen Welkers in that room because, first of all, he was all over the place, mostly talking about Washington, D.C., but over and over again, those words, where is the evidence, could have been asked by the reporters but wasn't. Where is the evidence about the misstated crime data for the city of Washington? Where is the evidence when he talked about how all of these people are being detained or the worst of the worst criminals? You know, and I could go on and on, but over and over again, where is the evidence that the oil will go down?
Can you imagine another politician getting away with Mm-mm. saying, I love inflation?
No.
And I don't, I look at that, I just, that to me is, however you feel, that seems to me something that even on the right, people would say, oh, is that, It just doesn't seem like something you say.
Well, if you listen to the Republicans yesterday, because I always like to listen to their spin on whatever thing the president has said, they said we were taking that out of context. And so I listened again and again and saying, where is the context that I'm missing? I think, you know, maybe he thinks if it's really high when it starts to fall, it'll be that much better that he's had this significant drop. You know, the bottom line here is we're in Iraq or in Iran, and we need to figure out a way out of this mess. I was hoping the president was just going to say, I won, and walk away and hope that, you know, that will just stop the violence. But
that would be enough.
And the military might is not going to do this. We're not going to put, let's hope we don't put we don't put people actually on the ground here. Because that is the danger when you let the testosterone rule. Where are the diplomats, and where? I think Trump just is worried about remaking Washington. It went wrong. He didn't think it was going to go like this, and now he doesn't know how to get out of it.
And Joe, you know, you said get away with saying that. I love the inflation. I think that he's not going to get away with it. I think that it's a high bar to get into Trump's top 10 most memorable quotes, but that I love the inflation has a chance of getting in there. I think that if Libby were running, you know, any congressional campaign in the country or any U.S. Senate in the campaign in the country, Libby, you would already have an ad cut, right, with that quote yesterday. I love the inflation.
I love inflation.
And that's going to be tied to every single Republican U.S. senator up for reelection. That's going to be tied to every single member of Congress up for reelection. I love the inflation. There's a story in Newsday today that over the last 3 months, gas prices on Long Island are up 46%. 46%. Mm-hmm. And the inflation and the oil prices, it's something that, you know, when oil goes up, every single thing that a human being sees around them every day, every single thing you interact with and touch in terms of a product standpoint has an embedded cost of oil. And having these energy prices go up is a disaster for the economy, for the country. And that quote from Trump yesterday, he already wishes he didn't say it. He knows he stepped in it, and that was a really dumb comment.
And then he blames the Federal Reserve for not lowering interest rates.
So the Federal Reserve. So his guy Warsh, who he just appointed, has a
local guy.
Yes, from upstate New York, likes the track. He has his first Fed board meeting, I think, in the coming days. And Warsh is a smart guy. There's only one thing to do when you have a 4% inflation print, and that is to increase interest rates. There's only one thing to do, and for him, if he has a tough decision, he may, you know, that there's an open debate, he may just leave rates the same. But if he's doing what a Federal Reserve chairman is prescribed to do when you see high inflation, it is to raise interest rates. It's as simple as that. You learn that on the first day of Econ 101.
JP, can I ask you a question? You're the finance guy. You know finance, right? Yeah.
Sure.
that's Mark Whitman, but that's okay.
No, I know. Yeah. Well, I was going to say we might have to phone a friend.
This is your wheelhouse.
We'll call Mark Whitman.
Mark's not here. I think you can do this. So I was just at the end of the day yesterday. I was looking at Market Watch, you know, the markets. And because it had dropped a lot, I want to see how much it dropped. But the VIX, which has always fascinated me. So markets were down almost 1,000 points. The Dow, the S&P, you know, 1.62. But the VIX, which is the, you know, the fear index, up 11.83%. I don't know enough to understand, but that seems a lot to me. Is that, I mean, because that says over the next, what is it, 30 days, 60 days, this is volatility the markets will, because it just seems like he keeps saying it's going to go away right away. But if you follow, is it?
So the VIX is it's a bet on volatility. And it going up for me just means that there's a lot of activity on Wall Street. The fact that the market is up with all of that's happened this year, that the market is up, you know, 5 or 6 or 7% amid the war, amid the shutting down of the Strait of Hormuz, amid gas prices increasing, to kind of read the tea leaves of the economy is going to go in the tank or the stock market's going to go in the tank, very hard to predict that. There are a lot of in addition to all of this global turmoil in the market, which is and uncertainty, which the market doesn't like. There are also with AI and SpaceX IPOing and Anthropic IPOing
or not.
And OpenAI IPOing. There is also a lot of excitement in the market. So to you know, look
at
the VIX.
So it's just churn. It could be up. It could be down. It's not.
You can't. If someone knew, if I knew, I wouldn't be sitting here. I'd be like in Palm Beach, you know,
doing what Trump is doing, yes. Which is trading.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, you're talking about predictions that they're doing these prediction markets now, right? You can bet on what's going to happen in the future. That's probably fueling some of the rise, and it's going to fuel some of the demise of some of these people's checkbooks. Because it's a stupid thing to do, to bet on what you think might happen, and then, you know, you end up losing all your money.
Well, yes, and so the alternative, if you're an investor, is you can invest in bonds, which will pay 5%, mm-hmm. or you can leave your money in cash, which you know is depreciating
it's
now with bupkis. Inflation. Leaving your money in cash is the worst possible thing you can do. And
but bonds
you know,
aren't paying 5% unless you're in for 20 years.
Right, right but. Having your money in the market right now, people are scared to have their money in low interest paying bonds as well as cash because that's basically a guaranteed loser. And when you look at how well the stock market has done, it's done really well. But when you look at inflation, those dollars that you're making are not worth what they were 3 years ago and 5 years ago and 10 years ago.
Sorry.
I just have to pause for a break. We went through one. I can't go through two. Let's take a break. I know we have a lot to make up for over the last week. So we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue. We welcome you. It's been a long time for letters. We didn't get that many because when we were doing the very short shows, simply because we didn't have time. So please, if you're interested, the mailbox is open once again. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you, as we always do. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll return right after this short break. We miss you, and it's very nice to have you back and to be back from break and certainly back from a fun drive, and we thank you for everything. If you'd like to be a part of the conversation, all you got to do is go to panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Here's a couple letters. This is for you, Teresa.
Okay.
Deliberate attacks on civilians and civilian infrastructure, especially that which is, quote, essential to the survival of the civilian population, is not only a Geneva Conventions violation and not only a war crime under both U.S. and international law. It is a special category of war crimes known as grave breaches, for which every country is obligated to prosecute. As a result, civilian authorities and military commanders who plan and order these attacks could be arrested and prosecuted in any country to which they may travel for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I don't know why this is not more concerning, because over the long term, the sort of the level of it's beyond norm breaking. There's a lawlessness, and it brings to mind, I think, what was very important when Senator Mark Kelly and others in the military did that video that basically says, mm-hmm. follow the law. And the sort of the breakdown of these basic laws, it's for the protection of on all sides. I mean, it's going to come back to haunt us. It's wrong. It's morally wrong. It's legally wrong. And it's going to come back to haunt us. And what's going to happen to our standing around the world when we're behaving in this
happens.
Way? Right. I mean, but what's the long-term implications?
Rick writes to us and says, take this a little bit deeper. Donald Trump and his sons and his friends have been making a killing literally and figuratively during this Iran war.
Yes.
If Martha Stewart got jail time for her small-time insider
Correct.
Trading, these guys should go to prison for life. Donald Trump is manipulating the markets with his quotes and his sons, and cabinet and all the other demons that surround him. Are you using these inflated prices to make a fortune in the market? It is so obvious. That from Rick.
I mean, right in front of us is a news story today about an AP story about the wrestling on the White House, at the White House, and a reminder that Trump took a stake in the Worldwide Wrestling Federation in March, I think it was, maybe April.
UFC?
UFC. Well, no, it's the United parent Fight company. It's
the parent, the parent company.
The one that Emmanuel...
well, McMahon, right?
No. Well, McMahon owns the UFC, but no, he sold the UFC. Ari Emanuel, is that his name? He's Rahm's brother.
Okay.
There's a medical brother, and then there's an entertainment business brother, and he now owns the global company, and that's what they took a stake in. And that's costing, what, $60 million and using seven or eight federal agencies to do. But what about what's going on in Albania? Have folks seen the pictures of the protests in Albania because of... the Trump spying up, they're saying it was a private island that was untapped, and in fact that's not the case, and they want to put a huge development there, and it's all over the world.
Juliet writes, is it conceivable that this country needs to use the military-industrial complex for our economic stability? Actually, it's Jay who asked that question. Welcome back, panel, says Joanne. The country is being led by war criminals. The United States has become a rogue state. I have no words, says Joanne. CJ writes, both the USA and Israel are rogue nations. I hope someday there is accountability. Trump is beholden to the Israel lobby and billionaires. Perhaps Israel has stuff on Trump. He is compromised. This from Jeff. Trump has been a screw up his entire life. His current mistakes are nothing new. The difference is in the past, someone always bailed him out. First, it was his father. Then the banks had to bail him out to protect the brand because they'd stupidly gotten in too deep with him. Then it was the Republican Party, who increasingly found itself trapped in an abusive relationship with a mob boss. Finally, the Supreme Court gave him a get-out-of-jail-free card. Now, none of these institutions can any longer help him. He can't help himself either. That from Jeff.
But he's making a ton of money. His family's making a ton of money. It's the U.S. people who need to be bailed out from this, right? That they're paying the cost. And a K-shaped economy, what you were talking about earlier, JP, was the stock market. Well, that's only the percentage of people who are in it. But at the bottom of the market, I mean, the bottom of the K-shaped economy are the people who, you know, they can't afford groceries. They can't afford housing. They can't afford transportation to get to work or to do their work. And you heard it during the fund drive, right, from the food bank folks and the food pantry folks. The demands on those kinds of services have skyrocketed. You hear it from, as Libby, you were saying earlier on the way in, the story about the rural medical services, the woman talking about the number of people who have died because of lack of access to health care that they can't afford it anymore.
These people, I've said this before, this administration doesn't care who dies as long as it's not them. But the more people who aren't white in their book who die, it's okay. The number of women who bleed out in a parking lot, that's okay too, because they really just want women to be barefoot and pregnant. You can see it in what Hegseth's doing in the military with, canceling all these appointments and for women, they really only care about two things, themselves and money. They don't care about democracy. They don't care about freedom of the press. They don't care about any of that, of what we all care about. They care about themselves and money. And that is what's running this government, and that's what's running it into the ground.
Let's take one more letter here. I became a monthly abstainer.
Sustainer.
Well, thank you. That's very nice. This from William, I believe. I have a question. We all know the issues with Trump and the Republicans. However, how can people defeat them in November if given no credible alternative? The Democrats have no national policy, nothing to make people go vote for them. Trump and the Republicans will win again based on no united, focused Democratic Party opposition. It is this type of question that will make Teresa's head explode. Do you want to answer it first, though, Libby?
First of all, what people need to understand is we're just going into primaries now. No one pays attention to politics unless you're in politics over the summer. The messaging for the national campaigns for the midterms will start in the fall. You'll see some of it now, and there'll be press, and there'll be that sort of stuff. But there's not going to be any mail. There's not going to be any TV after the primaries are over. The messaging will start in the fall to impact people because the majority, the overwhelming majority of people, don't think about who's running for what until maybe 3 weeks before. We're seeing it now, right here in Albany County. We've got a county court primary. We've got the DiNapoli controller's primary. People are starting to wake up that there's going to be a vote in, what is it, what's in 12, on the 23rd, so in 12 days. You know, so I get what he's saying, and I do sometimes think that, you know, the Democrats are the biggest and most effective circular firing squad in the world. But we just need to give this the time it needs to really impact people's voting. And now isn't necessarily that time. What needs to happen now is all of those elected Democrats who have a voice and have a microphone need to really push back. And I would love to see Cronin and Massey do the same, but I don't think they have the backbone for it.
Tillis will do.
Judy? Yeah, and I agree with the writer. It's like the Democrats will likely take the House. They could have taken the Senate, but they could have had a much greater majority win if they had a better message and they had better perception among the American public. They just screw up time and time again. Look at the Maine race. I mean, they should have vetted their candidate a little better. Yeah, I mean, they do not do a good job. They let consultants have too much control and power over what they do. I mean, just look at what happened with the release of the report on the Kamala Harris race. I mean, mm-hmm. they just did a horrible job at that. So you wish that, you know, they have the ideals, they have the ideas. They just need to come up with better messaging and better candidates.
They need Stacey Abrams as chair of the party. That's what they need. They should have done this years ago. If Stacey had been made the chair of the party after Biden won, I don't think we'd be in this position. But again, you know, testosterone does tend to rule everywhere.
Well, and you look at how Mamdani was so successful. He turned every single question that was asked about him into the rent is too high, we're going to make a mm-hmm. more affordable city. He did not get into the social issues. He did not get into climate. He was all about affordability and in people's pocketbooks. And, That's how to win.
And the Democrats have
the number
that.
One issue.
Right. The Democrats will have that issue.
Yeah.
There's no two ways about it.
Yeah. But you know, Libby, you mentioned the betting markets. I looked at the betting markets the other day. It looks like right now it's an 85% chance that the House is going to go Democratic, which mm-hmm. I would say is as close to a sure thing as you can get. The Senate, 55%. So more like a coin flip on the Senate. And Judy, you mentioned Maine. That's going to be a very interesting race.
Yes.
You know, Plattner is a horrible candidate, but Susan Collins, they've got this video of her saying, you know, there should be term limits, and it's her like 30 years ago saying she'd only serve for 12 years. So she's also not a strong candidate. And then Texas, you know, people are excited about this Texas candidate, Tallarico, but I'm sorry, I saw Texas over and over. Remember Beto O'Rourke? You know, the Democrats spend $100 million on Beto O'Rourke, and there are so many other candidates that would have said, we would love some of that money to go to us for a race not in Texas. You know, Ken Paxton is a former attorney general. He's won statewide office. He's not a good guy, but it's hard to believe that they're going to go for it.
Tallarico is not...
I know. People like Tallarico. I know. So you're going to go for it again.
I mean, Tallarico is an elected official. He knows how to put a sentence together. He's been very effective in pushing very back effective. When they called him trans, and he brings out his beautiful girlfriend. I mean, it was like, give me, you know, they have nothing else to go on but personal attacks like that.
They called him Tallarico, and he had the T-shirts out within 24 hours of celebrating
Everybody's
that.
Everybody's excited about Tallarico. I'm just saying it's Texas.
But
and they've got their other U.S. senator is who? Ted Cruz.
Right,
Lion Ted, okay? This guy Paxson, he's won statewide office.
But he's
been convicted repeatedly.
I would not invest in Texas.
All right, Teresa, I owe you time. I know that. But we do have a break. So let's go to that. And when we come back, we'll start with this. And people can chime in as well. We'd love to hear from our listeners. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll get in all of it right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Teresa Bourgeois, J.P. Miller, and Libby Puss with us. Judy Patrick was with us. She, because of the recording schedule of the Media Project, went from Studio A to Studio D to record that. So we lost her as a panelist. So we are, but you can hear her comments on a wide range of issues coming up on the Media Project later this week. All right, Teresa, I promised you we were talking about this, and it was a letter that came in regarding the Democratic Party and the responsibility of the Democratic Party and the thought of the listener who thinks that the party isn't doing enough and is squandering opportunities. I know this is something that has troubled you in the past, but I wanted to give you full time to address it.
Yeah, I just think this notion that we don't know what the Democrats would do, I mean, health security, economic security, national security. And, you know, you can know what the Democrats are going to do because there's a long-term pattern of it. They're going to focus on access to health care. They're going to focus, as the Biden administration had an incredibly, for whatever you want to say about Joe Biden, their administration legislatively had an incredibly productive time with massive infrastructure. People talked about infrastructure for years. They delivered on it. They took the lead. Trump takes the credit, but they took the lead in prescription drugs, bringing down the price, negotiating prescription drugs. The Trump administration just hasn't followed on that lead. They're going to have a clean energy economy. And the Biden administration, it was across the board. Preparing the workforce, and just shifting to a clean energy economy, not a drill baby drill, and give all of these incentives to the oil and gas companies. They're going to focus on the working class Americans, as opposed to we have a K-shaped economy, and much of the Republican agenda focuses on the top 1%, and the Democrats focus more broadly. So I just think that there are a number of emerging rising stars. There's some other stalwarts who can steady the country. I just think that the notion that there aren't good candidates all around the country, I think it's wrong. And also, I think if you look at there's really some good news in these primaries, because in two cases, mm-hmm. look at what happened in Iowa with the Trump-backed candidate for governor. Right, he didn't succeed, and I think South Carolina is the other one that. I think that the people are, your vote is your voice, right? And they are voting, and they don't like what they see with the Trump administration, and so I do think that I am worried about the main race. I do, but again, Plattner wasn't the pick of Senator Schumer and others, and he was criticized for that, right? It is frustrating to me that you have a very successful governor. No, she's not young, but she was successful, and that she didn't. She stepped back there, and Plattner stepped forward. We'll see what'll happen, but I think Texas Tallarico is a really exciting candidate. In any case, I've gone on too long, but I do think that Democrats lower the deficit, right? They have strengthened the economy. But they build from the middle out as opposed to from the top down.
Anybody else? on that. All right, we'll move on to other topics. Thank you, Teresa. We go to another big issue. We did not, because of the fund drive yesterday and because our quest to get it done, normally we would have spent the better part of yesterday's show talking about the primaries and the key races. So while we're talking about Maine and talking about the Senate race with Plattner and Collins, we look at some of the other races that took place in South Carolina and Maine, Nevada, as well as I guess those were the big three, right? Those were the big three states. And the results in those states for both governor, Senate, and statewide races. What were your takeaways from that Libby post?
Well, you know, I think that some of the people we expected to win won. I mean, in the Maine U.S. Senate race, I mean, I know Plattner is, I guess, damaged goods at this point because of his behavior and his tattoo and questions about anti-Semitism and because he had the Reich Cross or whatever they call that from.
It's, I think they called it a Totten something, yeah. Tottenberg or something,
yeah,
like something, that.
Tottenberg Cross, which is used by the SS. But the other part of this is that, okay, he's got all this crap. Susan Collins has Trump around her neck. And that's going to make a big difference because she's voted pretty consistently with him, despite what we thought she would do, because she's not the Lindsey Graham sycophant type. And so that should be a very interesting race. I'm not sure that Collins is going to prevail there. You know, the South Carolina Senate, if we could take that and get rid of Lindsey Graham, I mean, what a coup that would be. I'm not quite sure about that. I think probably a Democrat will win for Maine governor. I mean, Janet Mills was a Dem and everybody loved her. And so, you know, there are these other races, but it's really about some of these House races. And even with redistricting, which is what I said before, there's no guarantee that the NOPs and some of those Republicans are going to be lockstep with the National Party and with the Trump candidates, because this is not what they signed up for. It's just that simple. The majority of well-meaning people, even if they voted for Trump the second time around, what he is doing, they didn't sign up for. They didn't sign up for mass deportations. They didn't sign up for people losing their health care. They didn't sign up for women bleeding out in parking lots. And I will continue to say that as much as people might find it offensive, because that's exactly what's going on. And that's exactly, you know, how this administration sees health care for women. They don't really care, you know. And they didn't sign up for the inflation and the inability to buy food. I mean, you know,
and
thankfully.
And new foreign wars.
Right. Thankfully,
and tariffs.
We have resources. But when I go to the store and just buy cottage cheese and fruit and maybe a sleeve of Coke Zero, it's $80, you know. I mean, I remember when I was a kid. I don't know if I ever told this story. When I was a kid, we'd go shopping every Friday night. And my mother filled up the cart, and we brought it, and the checkout person. It was $35. My mother made her recount everything because she couldn't believe that whole was $35. Now, this was, you know, what am I? This was like maybe 55 years ago, right? But people didn't sign up for not being able to feed their kids. They didn't sign up for going to war with Iran for absolutely no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, I think that the Senate is tough. I think the House, with those House races that are up every 2 years, that tends to go back and forth in waves more than the U.S. Senate. These U.S. senators, there's a reason why Susan Collins has been there for 30 years. You know, I'm not in support of career politicians like Sue Collins and Chuck Schumer doing nothing but being a politician their entire lives, but she is. There's a reason she keeps winning in Maine. It's because she's the most moderate U.S. senator. She, I believe, voted against Trump more than any Republican, and may have voted to convict him on one of the impeachment. I could be wrong about that, but and Plattner is. It's hard to imagine that he's going to win, but
we'll see.
That is. It's unfortunate for the Democrats that Plattner has become kind of the national story and the face when there are so many other exciting candidates around the country that have a chance of winning and have a chance of taking out longtime incumbents, especially like a Lindsey Graham in South Carolina.
So one of those exciting candidates, one of the primaries, was in New Mexico. And I want to give a shout out to Deb Haviland. She was a former member of Congress under Biden administration. She was the Secretary of the Interior, did a very laudable job at that. And now she has won the primary to run as a Democrat in that governor's race. And if elected, she would be the first woman Native American governor in the country. But she is a really interesting candidate. And that'll be a, you know, it's not a shoo-in for her by any means, but I think that's a very exciting race. And she's a very, very interesting emerging leader. It's not that she's that young, but moving more onto the national stage. Again, back in South Carolina, I think it's very telling that the Trump picked candidate, the lieutenant governor, Pamela Evett, he picked her to succeed Governor McMaster's in the Republican governor's race. And she's ending up in a runoff with a guy named Alan Wilson. I don't know a lot about him. The Democrats have an interesting candidate for the state auditor, Sands, and but it's not clear because South Carolina is such a heavy Republican state if he can emerge victorious. But I do think it sends a signal that Trump's chosen candidate, both there and in Iowa, did not prevail outright in the primaries. But it'll be, and I do think that there are a lot of exciting House races. I'm more concerned more globally about Trump's nonstop disinformation campaign about the safety and security of our elections and about putting this guy Pulte in this national security position. And this tampering with our elections is constantly saying they cheated, the way he talked about California. I mean, the reason the count was slow is because it's not that they were slow. They had $13 million mail-in ballots that had to be counted, and they allow them to be received until, I think, 5 days after the election. So they had to wait till all of those
The New York Times editorial on how ridiculous it is that they take so long to count their ballots, and that every ballot should be in by election day, and there should be a reasonable amount of time. This is not
Fox News.
This is not the Fox News. This is the New York Times says it. They're hurting their own cause by having these unending counts and weeks and weeks and they don't.
But it's not that they're taking too long to count. It's that the process allows the ballots to come in, and so it's not slow counting. It's not cheating.
And the New York Times editorial board says it's a ridiculous process.
But now you have the post office, however, changing the way things are postmarked.
Right.
Right. It's not when you put it in the mail; it's when it gets delivered or something to that effect. And it's changing. It's changing mail-in voting quite a bit, and so I think you might start seeing some laws passed in some states saying, "Okay, you know, if this is the case, and they're going to change nationally, they're going to change how the mail is franked, then we're going to push the date of acceptance of mail-in ballots to a week after the election to make up for that."
But I think more broadly, just to constantly be denigrating our elections process and saying over and over again that he won. He didn't win.
No, he didn't.
He didn't win. Where's the evidence? Right. And our systems are not rigged. And there are lots of checks and balances on them. And that weakens our democracy. And it's very, very intentional. I mean, just go. If you write on the ideas and the issues, you don't need to do mid-century gerrymandering to try to, you know, navigate a win for yourself.
That shows how weak they are.
It is. These are all a sign of weakness.
Well, I would say if you watched the Kristen Welker interview and you saw how upset the president got when she continued to press on him, it's clear to everybody that, you know, he lost. He knows that he lost. He hates being pressed on whether he lost or not. He hates getting pressed on January 6th. That can be true at the same time that it can be true that we need to have elections, have certainty of who won or lost within a reasonable period of time, and having lead changes of who's in first and who's in second place in terms of an election weeks after the vote is something that also voters don't like. It calls into question the process, and states and localities that run elections should put in place a process that is timely in terms of announcing a winner. And that's not just me saying that. It's the New York Times editorial board who says that.
So I don't disagree with you, and I'm interested, and I'm creating a new
storyline.
Well, yes. But my issue too is just this whole runoff, who of how many candidates, of who advances, who doesn't advance. You need this, you need that. I mean, isn't that part of the problem too? Like, I don't know that it's necessarily the counting as it is that you have to do, well, if this is it, but if you're wearing brown shoes that day, then it's different. If it's, I just don't know how.
This is what I'm not articulating clearly enough. Easy for me to say.
Well, I think you're articulating better than I did. Go ahead.
And JP, I think we're in, you know, adamant agreement. We're just talking. I'm not articulating clearly enough. What the Trump-Vance administration is describing as something nefarious and inappropriate counting, and that there's something being done that's wrong in the system, I don't think it is that. It's because of the rules they play by. They play by rules that has this jungle primary, which gets to the confusion, Joe, that I think you're talking about, that it's a Democrat, a Republican, whatever. They play by the rules that you can mail in vote if you want, and you can mail it in up till Election Day, as long as it's postmarked Election Day. And then there's, if it's received in the next 7 days, it gets counted. Right. And more Democrats do that than Republicans. And so the numbers are going to change. But it's the numbers aren't changing because they're doing something sinister and illegal in counting. The numbers change because if you could do mail-in voting, but it had to be postmarked a week before and never received on the same day, they'd count on the same day.
It does make sense, but I also agree with JP that it does seem unrealistic to think that a week and 2 days later we still don't know the answer as to who the candidate is.
Right, but the reason
and there's lead changes, and it opens that process. That's the process. It opens it up to people doubting that process because it's not a great process. I also love the term. I also love the term jungle primary. I mean, that's a cool.
You're right.
Don't you want to compete in a jungle primary?
No, I think that's ridiculous, and they have to stop it. It's insane. It's the California jungle primary is insane. Oh my God, no!
That's... my goodness, you just gave meat to a tiger. Good Lord!
Which primary are they talking about? All of them, or some in specific?
The jungle primary for the race for governor, the race for LA mayor,
okay.
Where you vote. It's an open voting. You don't vote for a Democrat or Republican.
Which
you
is
just
insane.
Vote. And then,
but this is what I'm saying. I mean, that's the system.
Somebody 10 years ago thought it was a good idea.
Yeah, to open primaries
and to have open primaries, and that is just not.
And that's what I'm saying about the counting. I mean, is it the counting or is it this? Or is it both really coming together? Because you have so many peculiarities as to, and you just said it, lead changes. I mean that. that's going to screw everybody up because it does. Well, how was he winning yesterday and not today? And then it becomes like you know there's going to be a recount. You know it's going to go here, and that's going to take even longer.
Okay, but Trump said the same thing when voting, when they were, you know, how come at 9 o'clock I was ahead and at 2 o'clock in the morning I'm not ahead?
That's what happens.
Right? Because at 9 o'clock the rural areas had come in, and by
well, I would
2
argue...
o'clock in the morning the urban vote came in because it's 3 times bigger, and so now he's not ahead anymore.
Okay, I argue.
This is boring. Am I being boring?
No, no. This seems a little
boring.
This is good.
I'm sorry. I'm just like.
Thanks for the reassurement.
I feel like I've let us down a really boring path.
You know, when the guests seem bored, that's bad.
Boring people with this.
No, my point though is that with Trump, I mean that is rather nonsensical. To me, however, it is still within the confines of a day, whereas this is something that is now being protracted over a week. Look, my brother ran for a race. We didn't know if he had won for 2 weeks, yeah. 2.5 weeks. They had to do a recount. They had to wait for all the ballots.
Right.
And that's, you know, and as you said, the rule, well, and it chose the democracy. It's very mixed and that's how it worked, and we waited, and we waited, and we waited, and there was a recount, and we waited, and we waited, and then, you know, and then he won.
I've got a client who won,
These are the rules you play.
Right, who didn't win, I think, on election night, then she won in the recount, and then the person she threw out sued, and now it's at the appellate division, you know, of the state Supreme Court, and, you know, the election was in November. We are now in June, and we still don't know who won that race. That's what happens. And, you know, when you have a lot of mail-in ballots, which I'm sure California does, right, you know, it does take a long time to open the ballots, validate the ballots, make sure it's the person who signed the envelope, then running it through the scanner. I mean, it does take time. And these open primaries just make it even more difficult to really get things going because you've got people voting for all these various candidates. And it's not like New York where we're a closed primary. My attitude is if you want to vote on a party's candidate, join the party. Don't do these open primaries. Why should a Republican or an independent voter have a say in who the Democratic nominee is? It just never made sense to me that, because I know Alan loved the open primary because that's what they have in Massachusetts, and he could always vote because he was an independent, which is great. Most journalists are. But sorry, you know, I mean, yes, I cut my political teeth in Albany County where it is only about the primary. And if you win the primary here, you usually win. But it's insane. And the New York Times, because I just scanned what they had to say, you know, should know how difficult it is. Plus, on top of all of that, you have budget cuts to the state, to boards of elections all the time, right? And Trump's cutting federal funding for election integrity. I mean, there's all kinds of factors in play here.
All right.
And taking control of one of the things that Republicans
to take control of
it. Very, very diligent, just like early on they took control of school boards. They have been diligent about taking control of the mechanisms of voting, the positions and key mechanisms of voting. But the constant drumbeat by the Trump Vance administration chipping away at the American people's faith in our election system, I think is deeply, deeply troubling. It's an assault on our democracy.
Yeah, disgusting. Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's what I worry about.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll finish up our time together on this Thursday morning. We'll do so right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. J.P. Miller, Teresa Bourgeois, and Libby Post with us. We're amongst friends on, always our friends, but it's very nice as we come back and after a fun drive and do the show to have you all here and talk about the many topics and some that we didn't get to while we were making the money, getting to the goal, which, again, we thank you so much for what you have done. 15 minutes or so. We took a poll within the studio during the break and said, what story do you want to discuss? And this is what we came up with. More women getting shut out from senior positions in Trump's second term. A Washington Post review shows the president built a more male-dominated cabinet this term, and every departure has been a woman with a man chosen to replace each of them. Now, some of this, I think, on the face of it, is not a huge surprise. However, the two things that I think are perhaps surprising. One is that it seems to be a mission rather than a coincidence.
You think?
Yes, I do. And but in the sense of that, we are seeing that it shows itself in the people who are being asked to depart, and then who is replaced, who they are replaced. Mm-hmm. With we also see it pervasive throughout various departments and positions within the federal government, whether it be the Department of Defense or Education, or the list goes on and on and on. From the Washington Post, nearly 10 years after their first bilateral meeting inside Beijing's Great Hall of the People, President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping again gathered last month for discussions about U.S.-China relations. Much had changed over the preceding decade. Wars had broken out in Europe and the Middle East, shifting global alliances, the coronavirus pandemic, the makeup of aides and advisors sitting alongside of each leader for the high-visible talks was also visibly different. Images from Trump's meeting with Xi in 2017 show Trump sitting alongside a large group of senior U.S. officials, including three women. Xi staff also included a woman. During their most recent meeting inside the same room in May, every U.S. and every Chinese official at the table was a man. The all-male delegation exemplifies a broader trend within the Trump administration's hiring practices for senior executive branch roles that require Senate approval. Data reviewed by the Washington Post shows that Trump has selected fewer women to serve in these senior roles than during the same period of his first term. There also has been a historic amount of turnover among women within the Trump cabinet. The Trump White House has expressed pride in the fact that some key senior staff have been the first women to hold certain titles, including Susie Wiles as chief of staff, and defended the president's hiring choices in a statement to the Post. According to the Partnership for Public Service, a nonprofit that says it aims to build a better government and a stronger democracy, Trump's Senate-confirmed appointees are made up of the smallest percentage of women of any administration since George W. Bush. A political appointee tracker, PPS, launched with the Post in 2016, monitors appointments to roughly 800 executive branch positions, a portion of more than 1,300 positions that require Senate confirmation. It includes all full-time civilian positions in the executive branch that require Senate confirmation, except for judges, marshals, and U.S. attorneys. When excluding ambassadors and holdovers from previous administrations, PPS data shows that so far in this administration, about a year and 4 months in, 14.53% of all nominees or Senate-confirmed political appointees, 51 out of 351 total roles, are women. At this point in President Joe Biden's term, women had been nominated for 199 out of 369 roles. 79 roles, comprising 52.5% of appointees. Oh, Libby.
Oh, well, this just underscores the misogyny of this administration. And, you know, when Pam Bondi got fired, it was really clear some heads were going to start to roll, because she was like, Miss, I'll do anything you want, Mr. President, within reason. Well, I'll do anything you want, Mr. President.
Keep going.
Right? you know, I'll go after the people you hate. I'll do, you know, and she gets fired over the Epstein stuff because she couldn't contain it. Well, nobody can contain that stuff. Noam is fired because for whatever reason, but she wasn't really competent enough to have the job either, right? And, you know, it's this administration does not care about diversity. Now, we know they went after DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. They see any woman in any position as DEI, and they're going to get rid of it. Same thing with the military. We know what Hegseth is doing to women and people of color in the military. They want a white country, and they're not going to get it. And now the numbers are coming out that it's clear that we're going to have a majority-minority population in this country sooner than many thought, and it's scaring the bejesus out of these people, and they're trying to put in as much safeguards to make sure that they can stay white and rich for as long as they can.
J.P. Miller, what say you?
I was surprised when Trump nominated Susan Wiles or Wiles on
Susie Wiles
as her chief, as his chief of staff, and she was the first ever female chief of staff of any president of the United States. I was shocked that over the last 30 or 40 years that no other president, Obama, Biden, Carter, any of these Democrats, hadn't appointed a female chief of staff, and it was kind of wild that Trump was the first. That being said, it seems like you know, they are eradicating females from leadership positions in the White House right now, and that is to their own detriment. You know, I my first job out of college, I worked for a female member of Congress. I've worked on a lot of campaigns where there are female campaign managers. I worked for a female hedge fund manager. And as a guy, you know, Joe, when there's a group of guys in the room, it might be fun for a while, but at some point, bad decisions are made. And you need to have women in the room to make good decisions. And in my experience, females have a different makeup and constitution than males in terms of how they think about the world and how they think about organizations. And you need to have them there. And the less of them there are in the White House, the worse it's going to be for them.
Teresa. Yep.
So this is, I mean, the 14% versus of the Trump administration appointees versus 52% from the Biden administration tells you everything you need to know. I mean, I think about the, who was it that said, I have a binder of women.
Mitt Romney.
Yeah, I have a binder of women. I mean, that was well-meaning, poorly executed. But so I think he got harassed a little bit too much about that. But
he had a female campaign manager who was great. Beth Myers.
I do think he got a little, because...
And you worked on that campaign.
Yeah.
At least he was trying, right? They should have a binder of men and a binder of women. They should, to get more people into the mix. But it's not just the political appointees. There's a separate report that looked at the data of the DOGE cuts, and by far, the vast majority were women and people of color, and predominantly black women who lost their jobs in the DOGE cuts. Because one of the things they did is look at anything that they ran AI through to see anything. If you're doing anything that resembled one person, a high-ranking military person, because 20 years before she had participated or led a diversity conference, gone. But they're also cutting out funding for women's health research. They're cutting out funding for violence against women's programs. They're cutting out funding for farming programs for young farmers to bring women and minorities and as they develop young farmers. It's across the board. This is the, you know, I don't think Trump is into the details of this. This is the Trump vote, Vance, Russ vote, Project 2025. And then, I mean, just think in the last few days, they nominated the astronauts. No women. No women in the next project. And they had a lot of blowback, and the administrator, the quotes that he gave were painful. About, well, you know, we really need to focus on expertise.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Right. Thanks. Right.
Yes, you should. You have more women coming up in the class than men, right? And So there's no, you found no expertise. But the other thing is, I was flabbergasted, I guess I shouldn't have been flabbergasted, but I noticed a post yesterday. The Air Force deleted the profiles, a number of profiles of women and minorities on their website. They removed the article about retired Colonel Nicole Malachowski, I'm probably saying her name wrong, because she's the first female Thunderbird pilot. And there was a profile of her because it represented barriers broken, and she right. had all sorts of military distinctions. They took her profile off the website. They didn't take the male profiles off the website who had achieved things. What is this about?
It's about misogyny. It's about what are they afraid of? Women.
But, you know, you cannot ignore half the population. I worked for Dr. Shirley Ann Jackson, who was the president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and she talked about the quiet, what she called the quiet crisis in this country, of we needed a scientific and innovation workforce, and there were not enough people coming up through the system. And she said to meet the numbers that we need, you cannot ignore half of the American workforce. You cannot ignore women. You can't ignore minorities. It has to be an all-in if we're going to have an innovation economy.
So let me ask you, Teresa, a personal question that you can certainly bat away if you wish. But you worked in Washington for a long time. You worked in the 80s, in 70s or in
the 80s? 80s. Started I got there in 79. I started working in Congress 81.
And
I was one of a few women.
Right. One of very few
very
women.
Very few women.
What was that like, and to make those changes, and for you to then see that be essentially frittered away?
Well, some of us worked really hard to make some changes, because I was one of very few women, and most of the women, I worked for the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime, and actually my office mate was this brilliant lawyer, but because the chairman was very progressive and on these issues. But there were very few women, and most of them were in clerical positions. But one of the things that happened, we realized, with internships, when the female interns answered the phones, the male interns were the assistant legislative people. And that put them on separate tacks, because if you're working with the legislative people, then you're going to get the entry-level legislative jobs. But I have felt in the last couple of years, like we're going back to that time. I went to the Harvard Kennedy School, and we, a colleague and I, were allowed to, in the Shorenstein Barone Center, put together a seminar in the second half of that, of how the lack of diversity in the media impacts public policy. And what we wanted to talk about is does it matter if you don't have diverse perspectives, so that you don't have diverse voices, and so you're not hearing everybody as you work on public policy issues? I remember when they were working on welfare reform, one of the issues was, as they sat around the table, there weren't enough women, there weren't enough people of color. There was not diversity. The reason it matters is, you know, JP, I think, as you sort of alluded to, you have to have people with different experiences coming to the table to work out compromises, so you have a range of views included. This to me is so deeply troubling.
It's silly, and it's detrimental to what they're think that they're trying to accomplish.
To getting things,
yeah,
getting
right.
things done. And Libby, you went through the same thing at the state level, but not only being a woman, but obviously being gay as well.
Yeah, well, you know, it was a long time ago. It was in the 80s, 84 and 85, when I worked in the assembly. And one of the reasons I left was because of the sexual politics. And nobody was hitting up on me, I can guarantee you that, right? I was this little dyke, you know, in looking like I look now, but, you know, a lot younger. But I did not look like what the girls who were interns looked like.
Right.
But the sexual politics there and the pressure on the women to sleep with members, and this was in the 80s, remember, it's not, you know, and with other folks, it was just really, really disgusting. And it impacts who ends up staying, who decides, you know what, I'll live through this because I want to get to point A. And if I have to go through all of this to get there, then I will do that. And I, you know, that was not something I could do, or nor did I want to do. But all of this, this misogyny of this particular administration, is just indicative of how women are still seen as second-class citizens in this country in some major ways. And taking people off the Pentagon, the lists, taking women out of the public arena goes to that goal of having our government be white, straight, and male. And that's what this administration wants. That's what they wanted before, you know. That's where we're going with the dichotomy between Democrats and Republicans. It's not, you know, it's the economy, it's all those other issues, but bottom line, it's these social issues. It's choice and it's LGBT rights.
But it won't work. There, you can't,
regardless of whether
you can't
it's going
drive
to
an
work.
Innovation economy without people.
I
right?
get that. I
you
understand
can't.
That. But these people don't care.
But the damage that what I worry about is the damage being done. The number, the amount of highly skilled people who are right now being lost to the system. Mm-hmm. The expertise that's being lost. Just if you look at the list of the people that Hegseth, the women and minorities that Hegseth has driven out of the military. Because of whatever his issues are, their issues are with women and minority leadership. It's just years and years and years of expertise, highly, highly qualified people, from the head of the Joint Chiefs on down, C.K. Brown, right? It was lauded. And you cannot remove this many people from the process without hurting the governing process.
We are out of time. I want to thank all of you for sharing so beautifully this morning. I appreciate it. J.P. Miller, Teresa Bourgeois, and Libby Post. Thanks also to Judy Patrick, who had to leave early for her media project taping. She made better time than you did. She's already gone. my thanks to you all. We'll be back with more Roundtable right after this.